Like the office they commemorate, presidential libraries are living institutions. Certainly, it is my hope that the Reagan Library will become a dynamic intellectual forum where scholars interpret the past and policymakers debate the future.
Welcome to a Reagan Forum, hosted by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. The Center for Public Affairs offers lectures and forums presenting perspectives on important public policy issues of the day, from politicians, authors, members of the media, business and military leaders, and more. In this week's A Reagan Forum, we go back 2 weeks to our in-person program with American playwright David Mamet. David joined us to discuss the release of his latest book, Recessional: The Death of Free Speech and the Cost of a Free Lunch. David Mamet is most known for his work as a playwright and filmmaker. He won a Pulitzer Prize and received Tony nominations for Glengarry Glen Ross and Speed the Plow. Feature films that he wrote include The Verdict, The Untouchables, Hoffa, Hannibal, and The Postman Always Rings Twice. But he joined us not to discuss filmmaking, but to discuss his book, which is a broad-ranging journey through history, the Bible and literature, examining how politics and cultural attitudes about rebellion have shifted in the United States in the last generation. During our Reagan Forum, David sat down in conversation with Reagan Foundation and Institute Executive Director John Highbush. Let's listen.
Thank you all for coming. It's a great honor to be here and to be among friends, and a great relief.
wonderful to have you, David, really. I'd like to talk to you about a number of topics, and I most definitely want to start with a book. This technology today seems to have connected us like never before. But it is also, in many respects, put distance between us, I think, and I think the point you make in your book is with no quality, no theater, nothing of great worth oftentimes on the stage, we are not gathering as a people together. And I wonder what kind of influence that has on the nation if we are to be as far apart as we seem to be because we're not coming together as we once did.
Well, that's the question that occupied me during COVID and got me writing every day. I said, I have to figure out what's going on. I don't get it. I don't know how this magnificent country has come to teeter on the actual edge of suicide in such a short time. I don't understand. I don't get it. And I spent a lot of time writing a lot of essays and threw out about half of them on my own hook, and the other quarter of them because my wife read them. And I tried to reason my way through, say, this doesn't make sense. What I'm looking at doesn't make sense. So when you write, the hardest, most challenging form of drama to write is tragedy. Because in tragedy, what seems to be a solution turns out to be the problem. And what seems to be the problem turns out to be the solution. So that at the end of the tragedy, we say, oh my God, it was there all along. And I didn't see it, right? So as Aristotle tells us in the Poetics, at the end of the tragedy, we undergo, just like the hero, recognition of the situation and reversal. So the hero, Oedipus, undergoes recognition, oh my God, I killed my father, and reversal of the situation. I go from being a king to being a blind beggar. But when we view a tragedy, it's so cleansing that we undergo reversal of the situation too. We say, oh my God, I thought I was the smartest person in the world, but I'm stupid. I didn't see this coming, and it's so evident. So I was going through trying to take some of the tools that I used in writing a tragedy. You say, if you know the answer right off, you're not writing a tragedy. You might be writing a pageant or a melodrama, but the author has to go through exactly the same things that the hero goes through, right? Which is a lot of pain and self-loathing and confusion to say it doesn't make sense, it doesn't make sense. I have to make it make sense. So I was looking at the decay of our institutions, the loathsome decay of education and of government and of the and of and coming up to now with the actual United States government is saying we have to have a ministry of free of disinformation didn't make sense, because I know a few politicians, unfortunately many of us do, right? So we look at them and you say, who are these people? You know, most of them aren't very smart. Few of them are any good. They're all in it for the money, aren't we all? But nonetheless, we are the gambling chips in their game. How is it that these people who are completely predictable, you know, as Mark Twain said, suppose I was a congressman, suppose I was a thief, but I repeat myself. How is it that these people have warped this magnificent, most prosperous and freest country in the world? So I said, maybe they didn't do it. Maybe we're looking at something else altogether. Maybe what these people are taking lessons from medicine, are an opportunistic infection that comes to the fore when the body becomes weak, right? So it's not the pimple which causes the blood disease, but rather the other way around. So I say, now perhaps it begins to make sense that what's happening is a decay of an organism that gives rise to opportunistic infections. You're run down, you're more likely to get the flu. Right? Mm. You're not eating well, you're more likely to have intestinal, your eyesight's gonna go bad, etc. So I say, okay, what is the overriding fact that weakens the West? And the answer I came up with was, from a certain reading of history, it's prosperity. That there's so much prosperity that we now have three generations of liberal nonsense fostering the idea that law should not be law, but rather an expression of feelings, that work is error, that strife is error, and that we have to give away anything we have to anyone who says they'd like it. So what we're looking at, I say I'm looking at not Biden or not Nancy Pelosi or not Antifa or not the squad, but opportunistic infections that are attacking a weak body, because we've ceased to base our actions on rationally, right? Which means, what are we looking at with the West? We're looking at 2,000 years of the Judeo-Christian heritage, actually more than that, you know, because the Torah existed before St. Paul and Jesus. So this gave rise to the idea that human life is worthwhile and gave rise to the United States of America, the idea that we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights that can't be taken from us except by force, because they weren't given to us by any human being. So this is an extraordinary idea that comes right out of the Old Testament and was ratified in the New Testament. Extraordinary. Never existed on land or sea. Bunch of guys got together and they said, what about a new country based on the Judeo-Christian ethic? So if we say yes, but obviously, like somebody says on a diet, right? I've gone on this diet, I needed to lose 15 pounds. I lost the 15 pounds. Hey, I don't have to stay on the diet anymore. I get it. I get the idea, right? What happens? You gain the 15 pounds back and then some. So what religion did in the West was kept our nose to the grindstone to a certain extent, right? Because we had a community that said, yes, I get it, but that's not a good idea. You know, it's actually written right here, the 10 little commandments. You probably don't want to break them, and if you do, there are going to be consequences, not only in the law, but in your community and in your family, right?
Yeah.
And so the country, the West, became so prosperous that we invented this new idea, which is we all have to be in touch with each other all the time.
Yeah.
That's called a mob, right? So we all have this little device that we all love. I'm addicted to it. You guys are too, because it can do anything. But in addition to doing anything, it does one thing that's not a very good idea, which is, and it's, you find it in the Bible, it's called the Tower of Babel. We're all going to speak the same language, and what we're going to do is we're going to build a tower and be like God. Because if we all speak the same language, we all want the same things, we're all going to build the tower, right?
Yeah.
What happens to that civilization? It dies. You know, as Ozymandias, King of Kings, or as the Roman Empire, or as the British Empire, at some point, in prosperity, we have to be able to revert to first principles and say not, yeah, I get it, someone else, let Joe do it, let the cities die, I get it, let's let China take us over, I get it, right? Let's diss the state of Israel, I get it. Let's let Putin invade the Ukraine. How does that affect me? Well, how it affects you, our good friends, the liberals on that side of the aisle, is it's going to destroy your life because it's already destroyed the lives of your children because you just gave them over to the state. So my answer is the society became so prosperous, just like a billionaire, right? When was the last time that a billionaire changed the oil, right? When was the last time that his great-grandchildren changed the oil or mowed the grass or had to go get a job or did those things that made us all human beings and yeah. Americans, yeah. where you learned that your feelings weren't important, but what was important is your behavior
yeah.
and that your behavior had consequences. And if you take that away and we have a society based on, quote, feelings, you have mob rule. So whoever's screaming the loudest last has the right to control our lives.
Yeah, well put, well put. You talked about all of this, you know, the social media, everything being reduced down to this little piece of technology held in one's palm. Meanwhile, you know, what is happening to art and creativity? Can you envision some of your really great works reaching someone powerfully on a 2-inch screen now versus...
No, but I'm 75 years old, you know? So I lived through the end of the studio system and the heyday of you know, the 70s and the heyday of the Broadway theater. But means of distribution change. In 100 years, we saw entertainment in this country go from a vaudeville into radio into television, into movies, into talkies, and then into digi, right? Every time it changed, everything changed, right? When you look at the history of the people who were in radio, who were they? They were the people who couldn't make it in vaudeville. And the people who were in television were the people who couldn't make it in radio. So all of these forms change, and every time they do, everything goes out the window. So everything's gone out the window yet again. But my question of anybody who's looking at the media was, when's the last time you heard anything funny? Never? Not in a couple of years, because as always, the society is controlled by the people who own the high ground. And the high ground is the passes through the Khyber, through the Himalayas, or in this case, it's the means of distribution, right? So God bless Elon Musk. He says, guess what, guys? Right? There's a new sheriff in town. So now we'll see.
Yeah, yeah. Let me jump to what I'll say is the value of citizenship. You know, in the last year, it appears we've had and maybe as many as 2 million people come across the American Southwest, and like it or not, now they're Americans. You know, and if this continues, in the next 6-7 years, we'll have another 7-8 million. What, I think you're a citizen of the United States. What value does your citizenship or our citizenship now have if anyone can, just by walking, you know, 50 feet across a river, become an American, whether they hide out or not, or whether we make them citizens or not? Where's the value in that?
Well, the value is that the people in power are whoring for votes, period. That's what they're doing. right? Are some of these people over here fleeing oppression? Probably. Would they like a better life? Who wouldn't? I don't know why they would want to come to a country that's so terrible and racist, but there they are. But if you don't have a border, you don't have a country. And so the people in power and the Democrats are perfectly willing to say, yeah, go ahead.
And if you don't have a country, you don't have citizenship, right?
Exactly. So a citizen has rights, and citizen has rights and responsibilities. And I wrote an essay in the book about this guy called William. I think his name was William Lloyd, and he was Lord Haw Haw. During World War II, the Brits put a bunch of guys, English speakers, on. The Germans put a bunch of English speakers on. Out of Germany, called Germany Calling, would be, ha ha, this is Lord Ha Ha coming from Berlin. Surrender, that fat fool church, bibbidi bobbidi boo. So one of the guys was named this William Lloyd, and after the war, they tried him as a war criminal. And he said, wait a second, you can't try me as a war criminal because although my parents were British, I was born in the United States. And I went back to England. I was raised in England, but when I went to Nazi Germany, the United States where I was born was not at war with Nazi Germany, so you can't try me as a war criminal. They said, "That's you, you know, you're so right except for one thing," and they hung him as a traitor. He was the last person executed for treason in Great Britain. And I contrast that with Nathan Hale, who was hung as a spy, and he said, I only regret that I have but one life to give to my country. But William Lloyd's last words are not recorded. So what they said before they hung him is they said, that's very funny, it's a great argument, but you have availed yourself of the protection of the crown all of your life, and you owe responsibilities. And they hung him. So if we don't have responsibilities, it's very difficult for us to understand what our rights are, right? Because if we say, I can do whatever the heck I want, oh, but you can't, right? Yeah. What is my right? What's my responsibility? Is my responsibility to pull a kid out of a burning building? Maybe, yeah, right?
With every right should come a responsibility.
Sure.
Yeah.
But when you teach, when you give, here's what I think is going to turn the tide to the extent that I hope that they don't do something really interesting in October, is that the people are going to say, gas prices, yeah, but more than that, you cannot have my kids. You can't have my grandchildren. I'm sorry. It's just not going to happen. I got friends here, several friends here, like me, a Jewish, pulled their kids out of school, and God bless them, put them in a Catholic school so they could get an education from people who cared about education.
Yeah.
So I went to college in the 60s in a hippy-dippy, and I saw the free speech movement and all of that stuff, and the chickens have completely come home to roost because now we're in the third and the fourth generation of kids who think that the purpose of college is to have lots of sex and get high and then go out and either go to the government for money or go to mom and dad. But the kids, not only haven't they been punched in the nose, they haven't had to apply for a job. So how do you learn your responsibilities of citizenship if you don't have to face the actual harsh injustices and the delights of the free market? You don't.
Yeah, you bet. You talk in your book about, quote, the folly of equity.
Yeah.
Define equity for us in the modern
I don't know what
sense.
Equity means. Does anybody? What does it mean? I mean, égalité, the French say liberty, égalité, and fraternity, equality, but we don't say that here. We talk about liberty rather than equality. Because finally, other than under the law, in what sense are we equal? Right?
Yep.
I mean, that's what makes a society, is people do different things better than each other, right? They have different propensities, they have different desires. One person wants security, the other person wants financial success, one person wants adventure, one person wants rest. That's what makes the society. Everybody has to do the same thing all the time. You end up with a slave state, which is what the the universities have become.
Yeah. And then in a broader sense, you talk about, go ahead, try to define equity. It seems as though we've been robbed of our language, or the left has been able to find a way to redefine for us either what words once had a common meaning or create all new, you know, here's intersectionality, mansplain, toxic masculinity, triggered, social justice, the homeless become the unhoused, bullying becomes microaggression.
Yeah.
Who the heck is in charge of?
Well, we are. Each of us is in charge of his or her own speech. And when we give that up, we're in a lot of trouble. And I began to see it fraying around the outside, maybe as much as 20 years ago, when people, even conservatives, said, this may not be politically correct, but, which is already granting the opposing side's premise. So one of the wonderful things about Donald Trump is he spoke English, right? So people looked at him and said, my God, you know, the conservatives said, my God, there's an actual guy, he speaks English, I can understand what he's saying, right? But the other side said, no, you're not speaking pig Latin, therefore you are not a politician.
Right.
And that happened to me when I first started writing plays. People said, wait a second, that doesn't sound like a play to me, right? Doesn't sound like Eugene O'Neill. It's not boring. What are you crazy? So because we have free speech in the country, I said, I don't know if it'll sound like a play to you later on. It sounds like a play to me now, right? And I had the opportunity to do that in little storefront theaters in Chicago, and with Gary Sinise and Billy Macy and John Malkovich and everybody. It was marvelous.
Yeah, yeah. By the left's definition, it seems that today if your skin happens to be white, you are a racist. So you're a racist, I'm a racist. A lot of people here are racist. Should the proper response to that be, well, you are a Marxist?
No, here's the thing. You don't have to have white skin to be a racist, you know. If you're a black conservative, you're a racist too. It has nothing to do with the color of one's skin. So the correct response is, I think, to, in polite language, oh yeah, right? Because here's the thing, you know, Napoleon, who's a Jew, like me, and, thank you. He said, who dictates the terms of the battle dictates the terms of the peace, right? Which is the truest thing that I know. You know, whether it's on the battlefield, or, you know, it's with the cops in the street, or it's in martial arts, or it's in a divorce, or whatever. My dad used to say, as a one-horse lawyer, it all depends on which pew you get into. That's how you know who's going to win. So if they can dictate the terms of the battle, I demand that you defend this, and I demand that you defend that. If you accept that, you've already won. So all you have to do, like my friend Buddy says, is in the Bible, is put on the armor of God and stand still. Say no. I'm sorry, no. And each of us has that capacity. Does that mean that we're going to prevail? Well, when you do that, you already have prevailed.
Is there a connection, if you look at what the left is doing in America, that, you know, from a Marxist sense, the elimination of the classes or to put classes at war with one another. Is race, though, for the modern day American Marxist, the new distinction that's taken the place for Marxists, for classes of individuals?
Well, I'm very proud to be great friends with Shelby Steele, and he said that the great secret is racism in America is dead, and it's been dead for a long time. So what's happening with, there was a book published in like 1780 and purported to be the memoir of a slaveholder in the South, and might even be. I've forgotten the name, it was the memoir of a white guy who owned a bunch of slaves. He said, here's how you control slaves. He said, you have to turn the young against the old, the white skin against the dark skin, the men against the women, the house slaves against the field slaves. You have to keep them constantly fighting each other. And then the other thing that they did in the plantation era is they made it a crime for African Americans to read, made it a crime to teach them to read, and they instituted what they called monitor squads that went between the plantations every night to make sure that this group couldn't talk to that group. It turned everybody against each other. And one of the magnificent things about African America is they stayed together, right? That it didn't destroy them, that they persisted and prevailed in the midst of this horrible 400-year-long oppression, in a way that, to a certain extent, my people, the Jews, haven't.
More from our Reagan Forum with David Mamet after this message.
The Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation is the nonprofit organization created by President Reagan himself, and specifically charged by him with continuing his legacy and sharing his principles: individual liberty, economic opportunity, global democracy, and national pride. We must remain vigilant and work together to share these conservative principles with younger generations. Your role is critical to move our mission forward. Thank you for your continued support. Please visit reaganfoundation.org/give. That's reaganfoundation.org/give.
Now back to our Reagan Forum with David Mamet.
Define for me social justice.
I give. Anybody? Nobody knows. Look, justice means making a rule, just like you justify a line of type. I make a rule. This, if you do this, this happens. If you do that, that happens. It's a rule. You can refer to it, and you know how far to go, right? You can stop short, or you can transgress it and take your chance. But social justice means nothing. When has there ever been a just society? Right? Society's not in charge of being just, but right? The legal system's in charge of being just. So the idea of social justice is based on feelings. I feel with my lived experience, as they say.
I have my own truth.
Yeah, I have my own truth. Okay, and, you know, until some guy holds you up at gunpoint, right?
Yeah.
So we're living in a time where the rule of law is crumbling around us. George Gascon refuses to press charges against the fellow who assaulted Dave Chappelle, right? We look at Will Smith attacked the guy, a felonious assault on stage, and everybody knew that nothing was going to happen to him. But something even worse happened, which was that the audience stood up and gave him a standing ovation when he got his award. That's the mob, people. That's the rule of the mob, and they aren't kidding. So we got to reinstitute the rule of law. Say, here's the thing about justice. Somebody's feelings are always getting hurt. That's a pretty good definition of justice. You got two parties. Somebody's not going to get what they want, right? But they have to believe that the one thing that they have to believe in, and we have to believe, is that the law is obeyed, right? Yeah. Because we say, although you didn't get what you want, you got a fair hearing. Right, and somebody's feelings are getting hurt. Because if you say anytime anyone's feelings are getting hurt, that person has got a claim on everyone else. It says in the Bible, the worst thing in the world is a servant when he reigneth. You can't allow weak people to take charge because as they're weak, they'll form into a mob. And that's what fascism is, that's what communism is, that they say, I'm nothing, I get that, but together we have strength, right? So what do they do with that strength that they have together? They do evil, right? Because you're always better off. I'm sorry I'm getting so philosophical, I'm so happy. You know, I spend most of my time with my family, so it's nice to be with some people who listen to me. You're always better off, curiously, to have a dispute with a strong person. because a strong person can say, I get it, okay, you know what, big deal, I'll let you win a little bit, all right, doesn't hurt me, blah, blah, blah. There is some worth in your position, right? Or if I'm going to have to stand opposite to you, I'm going to do it according to the rules because I have a little bit of self-respect. That's not true with dealing with weak people, especially in dealing with the left. They have to win everything all of the time because, like any codependent organization, they're dealing with a lie. So if they could win one thing, the lie begins to crumble. So they can never allow themselves to be seen to lose.
Well put. A minute ago, you were kind of heading in this direction of what we're seeing in America today, and the smash and grab and this anarchy and the rest of it. And I pulled a quote from your book. You said, David, quote, "The abandonment of the Minneapolis police station marked the beginning of the mature phase of an insurrection. As the anarchists solidify their power, it will be remembered as the Fort Sumter of the revolution."
Yeah. I mean, who ever heard of this? That people are going to give up a police station because rioters have taken over? What were all those riots about that nobody in the cities did anything about? I was talking to my cousin Eddie, who was a New York cop for 40 years, and he's out now, but he was talking about the riots, and I said, tell me about the most important thing about the New York riots. He says, I'll tell you the most important thing. Where was the mounted? New York City has this wonderful mounted squad that are there for the control of crowds. All somebody had to do was a ding, and the mounted would have showed up. There would have been no riots. But city after city is given up to, in effect, as I looked at the world around me, what I saw is this, that the cities have become open cities, that they have been, in effect, abandoned to the left and to the mob. That they say, we're going to let the teachers do whatever they want. We're not going to have any police. We're not going to have any laws against homelessness. People can defecate on the sidewalk. They can steal whatever they want. We can take all the illegal immigrants who want to come across the border. It's the definition of an open city, like Rome between the Nazis and the Americans, right? That there is no government. So that's what we're looking at. So the question is, what happens next? And the other question is, does it happen nationally or does it just happen state by state, depending on the political makeup?
Yeah, and let's carry that over to education. I want to pull another quote from your book. You talked about an inscription that appeared over the auditorium at Francis Parker School that you'd attended, and the quote above the door says, "A school should be a model home, a complete community, an embryonic democracy."
Yeah.
Now, in the book you wrote that it meant that it was the job of the educators to raise children. It was not the job of the home, but the mission of the elites propounded by the schools.
Yeah.
That's what's happening today.
Well, it's happened for a long time. I mean, it goes back to really goes back to Jean-Jacques Rousseau, right, in education and the whole idea of the Enlightenment. So part of the Enlightenment is the idea that the enlightened society must raise the children. So if you see his stuff very much in the writings of Emerson, I have no idea what he's talking about, what Emerson's talking about. I don't think anybody does, but it feels very, very good. And then in the writings of John Dewey, you talk about learning through doing and so forth. And so when I was coming up in the Chicago public schools, the teachers there, a lot of them were born in the 19th century, you know, when it was the rule of the ruler. And so it was the reading, writing, arithmetic, and we sang 15 songs every morning and blah, blah, blah. Then we got into learning by doing and the rule of educators. I don't know what an educator does. Is anybody? What? Not anymore. No, I mean, I know what a teacher's supposed to do, but I don't know what an I guess they're supposed to teach teachers. I don't know. So the question was, what is the purpose of a school? And the purpose of a school is teach reading, writing, arithmetic, and keep your hands off my kids. My son came home from the Santa Monica schools, public schools, like age 10, saying his teacher, his white teacher, was talking about racism. And he said, well, give me an example. He said, we got a black president. Give me an example of racism. And the teacher said, you should be ashamed of yourself for asking that question because you're white, and you should be doubly ashamed of asking that question because you're Jewish. This is your tax dollars at work. And all of us who've had kids in public schools, and the private schools they're both worse than each other, have had to put up with this. So to say, and well, look at this. The parents go to a school board meeting and they protest, and the FBI, the DOJ says to the FBI, guess what, they're domestic terrorists. What? How did this happen? Well, it happened because things got too big for their britches. The union got too powerful. The union is the big cash cow of the Democratic Party. And it's time to get some people in office and say, it's my right to educate my kids. What do you mean I can't have charter schools?
There's a news story came out last week, and it talked about anonymous administration sources are now telling the media, and the media is broadcasting it, that this fall we can now once again expect as many as 100 million cases of COVID infection again. So here we go with another round of the pandemic. But what I'm thinking is that this is being laid out there now in order to create another national vote-by-mail scenario this fall because of the great endangerment of the Democrats losing the House and the Senate. And I wonder if you see any, am I a conspiracist here, or do you think something like that's in the wind?
Well, I was born in 1947. About 18 months before I was born, they were throwing my people into ovens. So that was the big question of Jews of my age. How could that happen? How in the world could a civilized society let that happen? But we're seeing it happen here. We're right on the edge. And what happens if we allow the country to devolve into leftism is, I would say there's going to be re-education camps, but there already are. Right? There are re-education camps, and there's clearance attorneys that you have to go to get yourself blah, blah, blah. And people are getting arrested for having marched on January 6th. And the next step after that is the ideologues and the fools among the liberals who are, as always, the clerics, the attorneys, and the teachers who always bring about the revolution, are going to get put up against the wall and shot by the people who take over the country. And the question is what's going to happen in November and to what extent the left is going to pull everything out of, empty the golf bag and, put everything on the line. I don't know.
January 6th, good point. I worked on Capitol Hill for 15 years. Sat, watched the TV, watched, many hundreds of people getting their way into the Capitol, chaos, mayhem, the whole rest. What just looked odd as heck to me is that they just almost like they let it happen. They wanted it to happen. They purposely did not defend or prepare themselves to defend it, almost like this was, almost like it was planned. I know I sound conspiracy theorist, but it really does. I mean, if that's the case, if the United States Capitol is not going to be defended on any given day, let's all just go to Fort Knox and take the gold, because it shouldn't be protected either, or it wouldn't be.
Well, they don't have to go to Fort Knox and take the gold. The genius of the, I think starting in the Clinton era, is they looked at the cookie jar and they said, wait a second, why take some of it? Why not take all of it? And so that's what we see among Biden. They just keep coming back and saying, how about another few trillion dollars? Oh, what are you going to use it for? Are you crazy? I'm going to use it for future love. They don't need Fort Knox. So what was your question?
I didn't.
The question is, how far will they go? And the answer is, you got to read history. When Germany invaded Poland, they got together a bunch of criminals and they put them in Polish uniforms and put them on the border and gunned them down and said that Poland had invaded Germany. And that's the way the New York Times covered it. yep. for real.
Yeah.
Right?
That's
so right. what the whole idea of an agent provocateur, what won't they do? Right? You blame the Reichstag fire on the Jews. So if you're looking at tyranny, you got to say, wait a second, they got to be stopped because they aren't going to stop themselves, because tyranny is like, it's like a fire. It's got to find fuel. It's got to find fuel. It can't stand still. Because it's based on shifting sands. The power always has to be increased in a tyranny. Whereas a conservative might say, yeah, okay, I got my wife, I got my home, blah, blah, I got my car paid off, I got my pension, I'm fine, right? But if you're in politics, especially if you're on the left, there's always somebody to take it away from you, right? You can't stand still, you must have more power. So that's what we're looking at. So the question, and I don't know the answer, is what happens if the next election is, or appears to be, stolen? I don't know.
You know, talk about power. It would seem that the power over someone's ability to speak is about as powerful as it gets. So you're a writer. Talk about this Office of Disinformation.
Well, I love words, you know. You notice it's not called the Office of Information. It's genius that, as Confucius said, man does not hide himself. What does he laugh at? What does he frown at? Man cannot hide himself. They're calling it to our face the Office of Disinformation, that they're in charge of disinformation. Duh. And who is saying, wait a second, what about the First Amendment of the Constitution? There'll be no law prohibiting freedom of speech. The government should pass no law prohibiting freedom of speech. What about that? Who's standing up? And what about all them rhinos? I mean, I don't know. A guy called George Shapiro had this outfit called Strathcon. I think it's still around. And he wrote a wonderful book about 20 years ago about what's going to happen to America. And he was looking at everything that we see. And he says something fascinating. He said that the border states are going to become part of Mexico. Okay. So it's really interesting. He says because, you know, the Hispanics, they come over here, they work like mad, they love their country, they serve in the military, they love their kids, they worship in church, they want to do better things for their family. And they're the only people working in California that I can see. So he said that what's going to happen is that eventually they'll get enough of them into Congress that they'll say you can simultaneously be in the Congress of the United States and in the Congress of the state of Mexico, and eventually this will turn back into a Spanish land grant, and, you know, good, you know, God bless them.
Yeah, yeah. You talk about a sophisticated way to play with power. How about last week's purposeful leak from the Supreme Court of one of the most sensitive decisions the court will have made in many decades? What is happening there? Who is doing what?
The left is taking power and they're saying that the law doesn't matter. The people will take an oath to defend the Constitution, whether they like it or not. That's the oath that they took, and they're giving and they've gone back on that oath. And nobody's holding their hand to the fire and saying, go to jail, go directly to jail. Because who's going to do that? You know, the DOJ has been completely weaponized. Who's going to do it? Trump was trying to do it. But Trump didn't read The Prince by Machiavelli, which we should all read tonight. Because what what Machiavelli was saying is, here's how you rule, right? So Trump was a magnificent director, right? And a magnificent chief executive. But curiously, he had such faith in human interactions that he said, yeah, I can figure it out. I get it. The mob wants this, the city wants that, this guy's on the city council, his daughter wants a job, I'm gonna have to bribe that fire inspector, these people wanna charge this for the building materials, but I wanna pay that, I get it. So here he is working on the street, you know, for 40 years, getting along with everybody and saying, I get it, you know, everybody gets to have a taste, blah, blah, blah. People all do better when they get along. But he didn't know how to rule, which is to say, to lie.
the game.
Yeah, he didn't know how to, you know, so he let himself be sidetracked by a lot of people because he believed them the system, and he said he didn't realize how deep the swamp was.
Yeah.
Neither did we, did we? I don't think so. No.
David, do you think that he might actually run for the presidency again? What will this country be like if he does?
I don't know. What the other question is, what will it be like if he doesn't? You know, because somebody said something really interesting the other day. I said, well, you know, he has a lot of baggage, as we all know, who doesn't? But the other person said, yeah, but on the other hand, who do you want in there fighting for you? You know, who's got the stomach to get in there and fight? I don't know. Ron DeSantis, maybe Rick Perry, I don't know. Mm.
I know we are all watching President Biden from a distance. We mostly see him on television, but how would you speculate on what's happening with him? Is he just like anyone at that age having some senior moments, or do we have a real problem on our hands?
Yeah, he's senile. I mean, I've talked to a lot of doctors, and they all say the same thing. They say he's clinically senile. You know, God bless him, it happens. So the question is, what's going to happen with the 25th Amendment? Because they're in a lot of trouble, because after Joe Biden comes Kamala Harris. So I don't know. But then the next question is, looking at 24, who's on the bench? No one. There's nobody there. So they're going to, it's likely that they're going to look at the midterms and say, if I want to take power, I better take it now. Because I got nobody on the bench.
Yeah. We've got just a few minutes left, and a number of you provided some questions for David prior to him coming on stage. And they, it's interesting. Yeah.
Well, can I say one more thing?
Please.
Because I'm very good friends with a lot of younger conservatives who are all suggesting hope. And hope is a wonderful thing, you know, because it's a magnificent country and all of the pieces are there. They're all there. We're prosperous, we're free, there's more freedom than in any country in human history. And so one from my age in the final boarding process might look at it and say, oh, you know, it's all over. Guys, have a good time. I'm going to sit over there and have like a tumbler full of mezcal. Enjoy yourselves. But as Tennessee Williams said, suddenly there's God so quickly. And there was a guy called Theodor Herzl, who was an assimilated Jew, a very well-to-do Austrian assimilated Jew. And in the 1890s, he went to Paris to cover the Alfred Dreyfus trial for the Vienna newspaper. Dreyfus was a Jewish officer in the artillery of France who was accused of treason, of selling secrets to the Germans. He was obviously innocent, but they railroaded him. And so Dreyfus went there to cover the, and when they degraded him in the courtyard of the Palace of Justice, they weren't screaming death to the traitor, they were screaming death to the Jews. Mm-hmm. So Herzl looked at this, and he'd grown up as an assimilated Austrian Jew, hardly knew he was Jewish, and he said, oh my God, we have to have our own country. 1897, right? Everyone said, well, you're crazy. What are you talking about? What country? They said, well, you know, the Jewish homeland is, of course, the Levant, which is known as Palestine. Palestine is just a region in the words of those days. That's, Jews have been there for 5,000 years. That we had a country up there up until the birth of Christ when the Romans came in. We're going to go back there. The people say, well, you can't go back there. It's a sand dune. There's nothing there, right? It's a wilderness between the Mediterranean and the Dead Sea. There's nothing there. He said, no, we're going back over there. And so he started this thing called the Zionist Conference, 1897. Jews from all over came to this thing to talk about building a country. My great uncle was actually there. And they started fighting with each other, which is how we Jews communicate. right? It can't be this, it must be that. They have to speak Hebrew, they have to speak Yiddish, they have to blah, blah, blah. It's going to this, be going to that, da, da, da. And so he kept insisting there was going to be a country. And he said in 1897, he said, it's not going to be in 5 years, but it will be in 50 years. And 50 years later, the state of Israel was born, in spite of everything. And he said, if you will it, it is not a dream. So that's my message of hope to you and my message of hope to me. If we will it, it's not a dream. Thank you.
Boy, well said. Thank you. Great, thank you. This question is a bit apropos to the moment. How do you find the transition from playwright and screenwriter to political activist, political pundit? What is similar? What's different?
Well, playwriting is a very technical endeavor. It's all about engineering. There's two things. You've got to be able to engineer a play so that you're leading the audience from one scene to the next, so that in every scene they start off saying, yeah, I make that makes sense. And at the end of every scene they say, wait a second, I don't get it, what's going to happen now? And you do that enough times and you can form it into a play. That's engineering. And it takes, on my part, a lot of thought and a lot of planning. And the other thing is the ability to write dialogue, which some people have a knack for and some don't. But you really don't need to be able to write dialogue that well to write a play, because we see plays in translation. So we don't understand the dialogue, but we get the meaning. So it's two different things, engineering and inspiration. And so writing prose is a pain in the tushy, right? Because I have these wonderful models. For example, Milton Friedman and Tom Sowell and Shelby Steele and Victor Davis Hanson, who can write so clearly. I say, I have a secret weapon, which is my wonderful assistant and the best editor in the world, Pam Susemill over there. And my other secret weapon is my wife, who reads it and says, Dave, we have to live here.
Which event or book has most influenced your revised thinking?
Well, I think it's a great trinity of The Road to Serfdom by Hayek and Capitalism and Freedom and Common Sense and White Guilt by Shelby Steele and the entire works of Tom Sowell, particularly Ethnic America and Economic Facts and Fallacy. I hope you probably know all the books. They're all of them, just page by page, you read them and say, oh my God, that's so clear. How can I not have seen that before? And it goes back to one of the people he studied with was, of course, Milton Friedman at the University of Chicago. And I've read, it may even be true, that Friedman said to his doctoral students, I'm looking forward to your thesis. It can't be longer than 500 words. Mm-hmm. Isn't that great?
Yeah. David, I've got 30 more questions in no time. And I'm sorry about that, but I'm not sorry about this last hour. I knew this was going to be a wonderful, wonderful experience. And on behalf of everyone here, thank you so much for visiting us here at the Reagan
Library. You're welcome. And can I leave with one anecdote? Because the other day, I thought, it's been a long time since I went to a gun shop. So I go to the gun shop, and I'm standing in line. Finally, I get to the front of the line, and the guy comes up to me, the salesman, he says, smile, you're in a gun shop. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank you, David. Thank you, David. It's wonderful.
Signed copies of Recessional can be purchased through the Reagan Library Museum Store. Every purchase you make from our catalog, website, or museum store is a critical component to our success. In short, your purchase supports our efforts to extend the legacy of President Ronald Reagan. Purchases can be made at reaganlibrary.com/store. To find a listing of all upcoming events, please visit reaganfoundation.org/events. Thank you for listening. For more information on the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute, including information on how to become a member, information on upcoming exhibits at the Reagan Library, and more information on the legacy of President Reagan, please visit ReaganFoundation.org. And don't forget to like and follow the Reagan Foundation on all social media platforms.
Until next week, thanks for listening. God bless you.
Don't forget to subscribe to A Reagan Forum podcast in your iTunes or Google Play stores and on other podcast platforms as they become available. New episodes of A Reagan Forum come out every Thursday. Like what you hear? Check out our Words to Live By podcast featuring radio addresses and speeches Ronald Reagan delivered from the 1960s through the 1980s. New episodes drop every Tuesday. And don't forget to follow at Ronald Reagan on Facebook, at Ronald Reagan on Twitter, and Reagan Foundation on YouTube. Also, search for us on SoundCloud and Stitcher.